This is special programming on the novel coronavirus from North State Public Radio. I'm Sarah Bohannon. Tonight we check in with the North State's District 2 representative, Congressman Jared Huffman, about a $2 trillion bill created to save the nation's economy and set to go before the House tomorrow. We check in with the Butte County Public Health Department about their effort to set up emergency tents for possible patient isolation and a storage supply if a large uptick of cases does happen. And we hear from a person on the front lines of this pandemic, a grocery store clerk, about how he's been handling being in the public. Don't forget, we want to hear from you. If you have questions for us, leave them on our website or call our message line, 433-9216. For Thursday, March 26, 2020, this is special coverage from North State Public Radio. The most expensive and perhaps far-reaching bill ever to be voted on by Congress is expected to go before the House tomorrow morning. The $2 trillion package seeks to backstop a nation where commerce has ground to a halt due to COVID-19, and 3 million people have applied for unemployment insurance in just 1 week. Today, for insight into the massive proposal, NSPR's Mark Albert reached out to some North State representatives. He was able to get Congressman Jared Huffman, who represents Trinity County and the North Coast, on the line. Mark began the conversation by asking what the bill gets right and where it has major problems.
Here's sort of the top lines. This is a $2 trillion piece of legislation, and the majority of that money, and I would list this as one of the good aspects of the bill, is pushed out directly to individuals, to workers, to folks who are going to get furloughed, who are going to need unemployment assistance, to hospitals and healthcare providers, state and local governments, and tribes and small businesses. And that's sort of, I think, the universe of greatest need from my perspective. There is also about $500 million that is specifically available on a more discretionary basis for the Secretary of the Treasury to distribute in the national interest as he sees fit. That is a concern. That's certainly not my favorite provision in the bill. And we did insist on an inspector general, on real-time reporting, and transparency and an oversight board, but that's one we're going to have to really keep our eye on. There are also other types of assistance in the bill. Each American, as long as they make less than $99,000 a year, getting a direct check from the federal government, and the exact amount will depend on how much you make, but it'll be a check for individuals and then also about $500 for each child.
Weighing the pros and cons of the bill as it stands currently, and knowing the Senate already passed it, is it worth the trade-offs?
Well, look, part of that trade-off is that you've got millions of people that have been almost instantly thrown out of work and into great uncertainty. And if you don't do something like this pretty quickly, the economic contraction could become the kind of economic crash that puts your whole country into a depression. So I would say that there are no great choices in a situation like this. This is one of those moments where the government, I believe, has to step up. And the question is, how do you do it? I believe we succeeded in making the bill better for the people who need it most and making it less focused on big corporations. To the extent that some big industries such as aviation, the airlines, are going to get money under this bill, we also put in some safeguards to make sure that it can't be used for stock buybacks, for executive bonuses, and things like that.
Congressman Huffman, are you planning on supporting the bill at this time?
Well, I am, but I need to clarify for you how that's going to work. This is not going to be a bill where most members of the House physically cast a vote. Because of the urgency of moving it forward and the fact that we're voting on a Senate bill that at this point can't be changed by the House, it is being proposed for what's called unanimous consent, which means tomorrow morning it'll be brought up, and unless a member physically shows up and requests a roll call vote, it'll be voice voted, and most members will not even be in Washington, D.C. for this final vote. That's obviously not an ideal way to do business on something this big and consequential, but it's another reflection of the unprecedented urgency of this particular crisis.
That was Congressman Jared Huffman speaking with NSPR's Mark Albert. We also reached out to Congressman John Garamendi's aide, who got back to us but was not able to facilitate a call before deadline, and three of Congressman Doug LaMalfa's aides, who did not respond. Every day, the NSPR news team has been checking in with public health officials across the region. We're watching as many federal, state, and local press conferences as we can. We're bringing them to you live as they're happening whenever possible for our small team. And we're also keeping a daily tally of all the positive confirmed cases of COVID-19 in our region. Currently, the number in the North State is 16. 5 days ago, it was 1. So the numbers are growing, but we have not seen a huge wave of cases yet, which is good. And thank you to all of you who are working to make that happen. But even with all of the precautions, there is a chance a surge could happen. And this is one of the concerns behind a plan in Butte County to erect emergency tents outside the old county hospital in Oroville. Yesterday, NSPR's Andre Bayek spoke with Lisa Almaguer, the communications manager for the Butte County Health Department, to talk about the construction and testing of these tents that were scheduled to be set up today.
So this is just another step in our planning, preparing, and response to COVID-19 locally. Public Health owns two tents that are part of our emergency preparedness program. We've had them for approximately 10 years, and they've been in storage. So this is a proactive step to construct the tents and check the structural integrity to ensure functionality in the event that we need to use them for COVID-19.
And how could those tents be used?
So the tents can be used for a variety of needs and responses. They can serve as storage space for COVID-19 supplies in the event that we see a large amount of cases here, and we are provided supplies, a variety of supplies from the state. They can also be used to assist and isolate people sick with COVID-19 in the event that the hospitals experience a surge. And this means the capacity to treat patients at the hospital exceeds their number of beds in the space that they have. Now, keep in mind, part of construction of these tents is you look at things like how big are they, how many patients could they actually hold that need to be isolated by still keeping social distancing and space between them and for the healthcare workers that would be helping them. We're looking at seaming, air tightness, overall condition, and cleanliness.
Regarding the current capacity in Butte County for patients experiencing severe symptoms of the coronavirus, what is that capacity?
You would have to talk to the individual hospitals for their capacity. I can tell you that there's a couple important things. So if our local hospitals experience a surge of COVID-19 patients, more and more people infected will need to recover at home. And this is why everyone should be identifying a space in their home where a sick household member can be isolated away from other people. Ideally, they would have access to a separate bathroom. If not, there are shared bathroom facilities, diligent disinfection protocols should be taken daily, if not multiple times a day, to keep a bathroom clean. We also recommend that, and we have been recommending, that people gradually stock up on supplies that they might need to help a person recover at home. And this also underscores why it's so important that anyone who is sick with mild symptoms stays home. Heed the governor's order and then heed our direction to stay home if you have mild symptoms. The less sick people we have in the community exposing others who are at high risk, the greater chance we have to mitigate that surge. It takes every single one of us to protect ourselves, our families, and our community.
Is public health at all involved in any decision-making regarding the Butte County Jail and the health and safety of inmates, staff, and attorneys there?
Our health officer and director of public health have had many in-depth conversations with the sheriff's office in helping to provide guidance. There's also guidance provided at the state level for how jails should be making changes and responding to COVID-19 potential.
That was Lisa Almaguer, communications manager for the Butte County Public Health Department, speaking with NSPR's Andre Bayek, who is actually on the line with me from his home. Thanks for joining me, Andre.
Thanks for having me.
We just heard your interview with Lisa Almaguer, and briefly at the end, you two spoke about the Butte County Jail and what role the health department is playing in recommendations on how to keep inmates safe. And what's happening in jails is a story we've been following. I know you've been doing a lot of work on it. Yesterday, we heard from a defense attorney who you spoke with about how his clients are feeling. You also had a conversation with Butte County Sheriff Corey Honey about what's actually being done at the Butte County Jail. What did he have to say?
Yeah, Sheriff Honey said his office has taken multiple steps to prevent the spread of coronavirus throughout his jail. Public visitation has been suspended and screening measures have been put in place to protect staff and inmates. He said his office also has been granted the authority through the courts to, one, cite and release people brought to the jail on felony charges when there's a concern that person has been exposed to the virus, and two, release inmates showing symptoms or who could fall seriously ill if exposed. The sheriff said it's not a get-out-of-jail-free card. Serious violent offenders and suspects can be quarantined inside the jail if needed. And so far, no inmates have been released from the jail under that authority. The sheriff said medical staff just recently completed checking the temperature of every inmate, and none of them showed signs of concern. He said that monitoring will be ongoing.
Wow, they took the temperature of all of the inmates.
That's right. He said that work was completed on Tuesday.
You also spoke yesterday with John Lopey, the sheriff coroner in Siskiyou County. What actions are being taken there currently?
Sheriff Lopey has actually released inmates early to lower his jail population to better manage potential cases of COVID-19. His daily jail population has gone from about 100 inmates to around 75. Take a listen.
Our jail and the sheriff's office, we have a great group of judges and we have a great district attorney. And the probation department and the public defender and the court staff are all working together to identify potential inmates, for example, that may be close to achieving their full sentence in the jail. We've actually released some nonviolent offenders early. And because the courts are curtailing jury trials and other hearings, although they're still in operation, we have actually been able to reduce the number of inmates in the jail by at least 25%.
How are they deciding who gets released?
Sheriff Lopey said public safety is a priority.
Nobody is released unless they meet the criteria. The criteria that we've established is nonviolent offenders. And we work with our other counterparts. Again, I mentioned a number of other departments involved in these decisions and, of course, the courts. And we ask the number one question, is this individual that is subject to release, is he or she a threat to the public or to other law enforcement personnel out on the streets? And if we can't answer no to that, then that individual is not going to be released. Secondarily, one of the big considerations is because of the potentially contagious nature of COVID-19, we want to minimize the threat not only to staff but also to inmates in the jail. So getting the jail down to a more manageable level helps us to do that.
That was Sheriff John Lopey, the sheriff coroner in Siskiyou County, speaking yesterday by phone to NSPR's Andre Bayek. And thank you again, Andre, for taking time to update us on what's happening in jails in Butte and Siskiyou counties.
Thank you.
You're listening to special coverage on the novel coronavirus from North State Public Radio. More just ahead. This is special programming from North State Public Radio. I'm Sarah Bohannon. Counties and cities across California will begin receiving shares of $100 million in emergency funding to prevent the virus's spread among the homeless. The funding is divided proportionally, with most going to urban areas. Agencies in Butte County will receive around $250,000. Combined, Colusa, Glenn, and Trinity counties will receive $37,000. The consortium in Shasta, Siskiyou, Lassen, Plumas, Del Norte, Modoc, and Sierra counties was awarded $262,000, and Yuba Sutter counties will receive $140,000. For an on-the-ground perspective on how that funding will help and its limits, NSPR's Mark Albert turned to Andrea Curry, coordinator of the Continuum of Care in Tehama County, an umbrella organization for groups providing services to the homeless. He began asking how much of the $100 million Tehama County will receive.
Well, $100 million is a lot of money, but it is split between the continuums of care and counties and large cities based on, I believe, based on the their point in time counts, the number of homeless individuals that were counted during the 2019 point in time count. So once it's split up between all the continuums of care and the counties and cities, Tehama County Continuum of Care will end up receiving a little over $56,000.
Now, $56,000, that doesn't go particularly far, but how many people are you needing to serve on that?
Well, we estimate our unsheltered population here in Tehama County at between about 255 and 300 individuals. And it's a dynamic population. It's not a static population. It's not made up of the same people all the time. So we can't really give you a full exact count, but that's what we estimated at. And what these funds are intended to do is to protect unsheltered individuals and prevent spread of COVID-19 should it come to our area, to make sure that people have access to ways to isolate if they need to, and then also to provide basic sanitation, ways for individuals who are homeless to stay clean and follow the hand washing guidelines that we've all been given, and also follow the social distancing guidelines that we've been given. Sometimes in traditional shelters, that kind of space between people is just not possible.
And that's got to be a major challenge if you're sleeping out on the rough, if you are afraid of being isolated and attacked and might sleep in small groups.
Sure. And also in an encampment, you don't have ready, quick access to, clean running water, utensils and plates, things so that when there's food, people may share without taking precautions. And we want to make sure that the people have access to everything they need to be able to follow those guidelines.
What are some of the options that are being passed around? Hand washing stations near the levee, or putting a select few people who are especially at risk in hotel rooms?
Yeah, those are some of the options. We are hoping to, like I said, secure a larger facility just for temporary use where we can have.
So that you could have the same number of people in overnight shelter, overnight emergency shelter, but have them spaced further away so that.
Exactly. We do have about a little over 100 people who had actually made use of that seasonal emergency shelter between January and the middle of March. And so that's kind of the population we're looking at who may be willing to accept shelter from us.
Must be a huge challenge to anyone sleeping in the rough or without access to shelter, having to pivot and deal with this on top of things. In your connections or your interaction with people, how high of a priority is amongst the homeless? Or how do you explain to somebody who maybe is mentally ill about the seriousness of this?
A lot of these folks are generally in crisis on a 24-hour basis. So adding another a public health crisis in on top of it, they may not have all the space or capacity to prioritize that crisis also. And also, they may not be as connected to all of these news sources that you or I sitting in an office is going to hear constantly. But they are at particular risk because generally they may either not seek medical care as frequently as you or I might, just for logistical reasons. Just getting to a hospital or a clinic can be challenging. They may not want to engage in services. They may have had experiences with people that makes them feel like they maybe can't trust the people providing services. So there's more to it than just saying, hey, look, here's a place you can sleep. You know, you have to build a relationship and you have to make sure that people are being served in the way that is going to work for them. It would be nice if we had access to the resources that we really needed to make sure that they get addressed while they're still manageable.
That was Andrea Curry, coordinator of the Continuum of Care in Tehama County, speaking with NSPR's Mark Albert. Essential critical infrastructure worker. That's the term for those working in industries like healthcare, law enforcement, and public works right now, while the rest of us try to stay safe at home. Those who work at grocery stores are also ECIWs. Today, NSPR's Christian Solis caught up with a Chico State student who is currently working at a local grocery store in Chico. We're not revealing his name to give him anonymity. Christian first asked him what it's like to be working through the COVID-19 pandemic.
The COVID-19 virus has been an interesting experience for us. First and foremost, we've been incredibly busy. I know the previous week we finished 130% above sales projections, which is great if you're trying to make money, but not great if you're already understaffed. As of this moment, we're all voluntarily working, basically. The company has come out and said that, like, if you don't feel safe or you feel like you have symptoms for whatever reason, you don't have to show up for your shift, and we're not going to ask questions about it. But that's put a lot of pressure on people who are willing to work, who are willing to, you know, fill hours. It's been somewhat stressful in terms of overall just having to work long hours. We're dealing with a lot of customers who are not necessarily the most calm individuals at this point. You know, there's a lot of, you know, people, I won't say that they're panicking, but they're, you know, they're sort of frenetically shopping, if that makes sense. You know, kind of, you know, there's a lot of tension in the air that you can just kind of feel in that kind of way.
So why are you still volunteering to work?
There's, you know, two levels for it for me. There's like the selfish individual level where I'm like kind of, you know, I like the money. If they're willing to pay me, I don't really feel like I have any individual excuse to not be working. I'm a relatively healthy individual. I don't feel like I'm at risk or, you know, necessarily as an individual. And then also there's an element of, you know, helping out the community type aspect to it where I'm, you know, able to do my individual part to help out with people, you know, whether it be, you know, helping them find the items that they're looking for, stocking the shelves, you know, trying to get them fast checkout, get them in and out as quick as possible, you know, limit their social contact with individuals. You know, I kind of look at it from that perspective of like, I guess I'm kind of doing a service in that aspect.
Are you concerned at all that you contract COVID-19 from continuing to work?
I would say weirdly last week when the panic was kind of first setting in, I wasn't. I had a very, you know, blasé approach to it. But in the last couple weeks, I guess as the virus has slowly, you know, made its way into Butte County and whatnot, I've definitely had honest conversations with both myself and, you know, friends and family about it where, yeah, I could, you know, I think of all my friends and family, I'm the most at risk to be infected by it by virtue of my job. So yeah, I would say I'm definitely concerned by it, but I don't know. It's one of those, for me at least, it's one of those things where I don't think it will stop me from, you know, continuing to work. Obviously, if I were to contract the virus, that'd be a different story, you know, in terms of the threat. I don't think it's something that would actually deter me.
What kind of precautions is your grocery store that you work at taking?
So the store itself has implemented a very strict cleaning regime in terms of disinfecting all surfaces, you know, could potentially even be touched by customers, by other employees, et cetera. We wipe down every single check stand and, you know, door handle and, you know, things like that at least once an hour. Things like the restrooms and the carts and the cart corral get cleaned several times an hour. And then also, you know, just recently they've installed sneeze guards in front of the check stands for cashiers like myself, you know, to help us both with protection measures and also to protect the customers, you know. And then the other thing that they've been doing a lot of is while we're not able to get a lot of hand sanitizer in for, you know, sale for the customers, you know, Purell and stuff, we're still able to get it through our cleaning service that helps clean our stores. And so we've been putting extra of that out, whether it be, you know, several bottles on the check stand, you know, one for the cashier, one for, you know, on the customer side. And then also just, you know, scattered in various locations throughout the store. So, you know, that's that sort of thing. And then also people who are handling money, whether you're a cashier, customer service desk employee, you know, somebody working in one of the departments with a register, we're being required to be let out at least once an hour to go wash our hands for, you know, the full 90 seconds is the recommended cleaning time for from our company, at least. They're kind of trying to, you know, encourage, you know, good hygiene practices.
What about as far as fresh produce?
In terms of fresh produce, we continue with the, you know, advised, you know, hey, make sure that you wash your produce before you use it. You know, and that's kind of been standard operating procedure forever, right? You know, and we've just kind of been encouraging that more and more. I work occasionally in the produce department and, you know, we've been told to like remind them, you know, hey, make sure you wash your produce before or, you know, before utilizing it. And then in terms of like, you know, we used to have very large bulk food bins. Those were all taken out. You know, we bagged those all up and put them in the back room just because we felt like the risk was too great to just kind of leave that, you know, free floating.
I feel like I'd be missing out if I didn't ask. What's the situation with toilet paper?
So currently there is no shortage of toilet paper. We're bringing in several pallets full. Each pallet contains 64 cases. Each case can contain anywhere from 5 to 12 packs of toilet paper in varying sizes. Our shelves of toilet paper are relatively full every morning at 6 a.m. You know, obviously we're not getting in the larger packs, 64 packs, 72 packs of toilet paper. But in terms of your average, you know, 12 packs, you know, 24 packs of toilet paper, our shelves are full every single morning at 6 a.m. when the doors open. The problem that we're having is not so much that we cannot get it from the warehouse. It's that we cannot get enough in no matter how much we order because there's such a large demand for it. I don't understand the demand personally, and I've had interactions with customers where I've asked, you know, before we started limiting the amount of toilet paper individuals can buy, we had customers buying multiple packages, and I've asked them before, hey, why are you buying so much toilet paper? And for the most part, the average answer is, I need it because I saw somebody else buy it. It's not necessarily related to the virus itself, but more to the panic that's been sort of brewing as a result of it. But yeah, as of now, there is no shortage on toilet paper. I worked, you know, the previous night and helped unload 4 pallets of toilet paper. So it's not that we can't get it in, it's that we can't keep it on the shelf fast enough.
That was a grocery store clerk in Chico who shared with NSPR's Christian Solis under anonymity about his experience working through the COVID-19 pandemic. And that's your program for Thursday, March 26, 2020. If you'd like to share your experience or your thoughts and concerns with us, leave a note for us on our website, mynspr.org. We also want to hear from you parents. How is everything going now that your kids are learning from home? Call our message line, 433-9216. That's 433-9216. Tonight's special coverage was produced by Mark Albert, Ken Duvall, Christian Solis, Andre Bayek, and Phil Wilkie. Our engineer is Matt Fidler. Thanks for being with us. I'm Sarah Bohannon, and this is special coverage on the novel coronavirus from North State Public Radio. We're back tomorrow evening at 6:30. Until then, stay safe, stay informed, and please don't buy up all the toilet paper.